Welcome, everybody, to the Board Game Barbecue Podcast. It is Mitch here, and I will be your host for this evening on episode number 210. Yes, that 210 is a special number. You know that, Jules? Because two is more than double one, and one is half of two, and zero is below both one and two. So there you go. A very special.
Very, very special.
It's one of those things I like to do with numbers.
You know, crazy basic like that. Math, grade one math. My son can do.
You're cheating. You're looking at the smartphone ink player aid, aren't you?
Oh, you got me.
Yeah.
All right. And in case you didn't know it, I'm here with my two compatriots, Jules, down in Victoria. How are you doing, Jules?
I'm doing fantastic, Mitch. Thanks.
That's good. And my brother from another mother up there in Brisbane, Adrian, how are you going?
I'm doing equally fantastic, if not slightly more fantastic than Jules is doing.
You're wearing a red shirt. He's wearing a black shirt. So, yeah, I might give you the edge. So we're here today just to talk about games and what we've been up to and chew the fat a little bit. So I'm going to kick things off just by saying I haven't played a lot of games lately. I've got a few that I'm going to talk about, but I actually dipped into a little bit of a adjacent hobby this last week because I bought myself a new Xbox.
Oh.
Oh, wow.
So Chicken I've been, Farmer? Not Chicken Farmer, no. No, I've been playing. I bought it to play Cyberpunk.
Oh, okay.
2077, because I was a bit of a Cyberpunk fanboy back from the old RPG days when I used to play D&D and we did some tabletop RPG Cyberpunk stuff, and I really enjoyed it back then. And so I thought, I got to get into it. And I had left it alone because there were lots of bad stories about that game when it sort of first released. There were lots of problems and stuff
glitches. With it.
So I thought, it's probably about a year old now, and I found a good deal in Costco of all places. So
fantastic deals.
Yeah.
They're really good.
Grabbed it.
Did you play it much? You've been playing it a bunch.
Yeah, but I did have to get Brad to help me because I'm completely, you know, inept when it comes to technology and, well, not technology in general, but just the whole, you know, gaming sort of scene.
So he showed really you, like, how often. To turn on the Xbox and how to connect it to your TV.
I guess it's kind of funny, right, because you used to rule books where you go with board games where you open the rule book and you go, oh, here's the rules, and they read it through and here's all the components and explains you how to do everything in the game.
Yeah.
So this game started and went, there you go, off you go, go. And I'm like, what? Yeah. What am I? How do I do this? Okay, that's shoot. There was a little tutorial about how to fight.
Yeah.
But like there's all this other stuff in the game, crafting and cybernetics and this and that, and none of it is explained. You're just going to kind of figure it out as you go.
But you sit down and give your mate Brad, right, a 14-inch DVD, TV, VHS combo, an RF cable, all the coaxials, an old Nintendo, and all the other crap we had to deal with, and they go, here you go, set that up. He would have no idea. He'd be clicking the things together like, this doesn't even fit in here. Why does it not do that? What's that switch do? What do you mean tune it? What does tune it mean?
Like,
you
know,
so,
I know, it's a bit crazy.
But, and I hear you played, what have you been playing Flight Simulator for?
I haven't yet. I was just about to start playing tonight before we came on to record. So I was thinking about giving that a go. Just because
I have fears of you playing that game and then thinking, yeah, I could probably fly a plane. I'm going to get some lessons. I'm like, nah, what an idiot.
You best check your pilot before you fly down to Melbourne next week, Adrian.
Yeah, it would be hilarious if you thought you could actually fly and then all of a sudden you looked at the settings like a year later and find out you've had all these flight assist modes and all the games on easy mode and all this, and you're like, that explains everything.
Well, put it this way, I've been playing some racing games as well, and if they're any representation of how I drive a car, then I should have my license cancelled immediately.
Awesome.
But I will. I'm going to do a little pitch here for Microsoft at the moment, because when I set it all up and whatever, I got all the apps and everything and connected up, and there was a deal on to subscribe to Game Pass for I think it was 1 month was $1. And then you could, you know, and resumed at like $10 a month or something like that. And I was kind of like, oh, what's $1? I'll just see what that's like. I'll get onto there. And I did. I'll tell you what, I don't think I'd ever buy a game again.
No.
I mean, it's the streaming sort of version of video games. So it's your Netflix.
The Netflix of video games.
And, you know, for what amounts to a couple hundred bucks a year, when games themselves are $100 each.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're trying to get that, you know, game that the day it's released or whatever, I think it's a phenomenal value. And so I've been kind of diving into that a little bit, and it's been lots of fun.
It's a very clever model. Like, it works really well. And they, I mean, I know we'll talk about board games very soon, but it's sort of a side hobby. Like, the fact that they released Halo on the day it came out on the Game Pass, so you don't have to buy a copy of Halo. It was there on the day it came out. I think that was just, yeah, it's a great move. And it's been real successful in our household. Like, it's been fantastic. So,
yeah. So, So, other than that, I have been playing a couple little games. I've played Twilight Inscription.
Well, that's a big one.
Which is a big entry into the roll and write genre.
Is it just overly big for being overly big sake, or do you feel like it's great?
I think it's really good. I think it fits. I think it fits a niche. I think it's I wasn't going to go into heaps of detail because I think I said to Def that we'd do a bit of a breakdown on it and a bit of a deep dive into that game at some point. But for me, it's not like Twilight Imperium. If you're thinking it's Twilight Imperium, it's not. It's not 4X. It's not. No. You know, you're not competing for resources and that sort of stuff. It's really just a roll and write with that skin on it. A really good one, but it's, you know, if you think you're going in there to, you know, take over planets and, you know, destroy your other opponents and that sort of stuff, you're going to be disappointed because it's not.
Yeah.
So it's not like that. But, and even though it looks enormous and it looks like there's way more going on than any other roll and write, it's really not that much sort of more intricate than you know, some of the other heavy roll and writes that we talk about. It doesn't have the combo-ness, so it's not like Fleet or Hadron's Wall. It's not combo-tastic. You're not ticking this off that'll give you the opportunity to tick that off, which lets you tick that off and so on. It's more of a resource management sort of puzzle and an efficiency puzzle. So trying to work out, you know, where am I going to put my resources so that I can afford to, you know, unlock other resources and things. So it's different. I wouldn't put it in the same basket as Fleet and Hadrian's and Three Sisters, those. It's definitely not as difficult. Once you learn the iconography and stuff and you understand a couple of turns, it's definitely not as difficult to play. Well, not necessarily as difficult, but it's not as difficult to play as what it looks like it would be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it looks like a lot. Like, it looks like, you know, the TI of Roll and Write, like, as in, it looks massive. It looks like it's got four sheets. It's like, ha, Hadrian's, you did two sheets. Fleet, you did two sheets. We're doing four sheets.
Yeah.
Bring it. Like, it looks huge, like on the table. It looks like a thing, you know.
One day we're going to see one with like 16 sheets and it's just going to be a behemoth.
Yeah.
But the thing with the four sheets as well, each turn you choose one to play and that's part of the decision space.
Okay.
So you can't write on multiple sheets at one time. Each turn you only pick one sheet, and what you do on that one sheet might generate resources that then you can maybe utilize on your next turn on another sheet.
Yeah, okay.
So there's interrelationships between the four sheets, but you're never actually writing on more than one at a time.
Fair play. Too many sheets.
So I'll go into that in a bit more depth probably later at some point in the pod. I've only played it a couple of times, so I'll really want to play it a bit more as well before I really kind of sort of know it very well. And, you know, me being me, I played against the solo rules, which is essentially a beat-your-own-score type thing. You do play against another person who acts as an AI, but your target is just moving up a score chart, and I was at the very bottom.
Yes. There you go, we'll play.
So, you know, consistency is my thing. That's what I'm going for. If not consistent, what else could you be? So how about you, Jules? What has been bouncing around on your table lately?
I feel like I've been playing a lot of games recently, a bit of a mix of new and old. One that I got to try recently was Scout, that reprint for Oink Games. And it's good. It's really good. It's just really satisfying to pull off like massive plays in one go, like a run or a, I I've played a few games and I got to play five of a kind down there.
Oh,
that,
wow.
That won me the game.
Yeah.
But it's just, it's really easy to learn. You definitely have to fight back the urge to shuffle and order your cards.
Like, yeah.
I didn't think I'd have that, but I was like, oh, I just want to reorder them. But you can't in that game.
Yeah, Sarah taught us at Comic-Con.
Ah,
so we
okay.
Sat down and she taught us all how to play that. That day, and I was doing the same thing. I got caught out cheating because I thought she said when you first take your hand, you can have that one moment to you can't rearrange them, but you can turn them up the other way if you want to.
Yeah, but it has to be the whole hand.
Exactly.
Not so, one card at a time.
Well, I'd go, I'll do that one, that one, that one, that one, that turn those up. And she was like, you have to turn them all up or not. And I'm like, yes. Oh, okay.
Yeah. I do like that decision at the start. You go, oh, I could do this or this, but sometimes it's obvious which way you want your hand up. But that was a real surprise. Whenever that comes to retail, I'll certainly be looking for a copy of that. It's really good. I thoroughly enjoyed it. It had moments that were a lot more tactical than I thought it would be in the game. Just you might have a really good you might have a couple of things you need to play, but you sort of need to win the trick to be able to go into it. It was just really good.
Well, I was going to say, this is the thing, they call it a trick-taking game, but it's definitely divergent from your standard trick-taking games.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because the puzzle's really about the runs in your hands and the numbers, and as opposed to really winning the trick.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, so I thoroughly enjoyed Scout. That was really good. The other one that was new to me that I got recently was Resist.
Aha, I've heard about that.
Yeah, hold it for some old guy. I can't remember his name.
Old guy, not quite the oldest guy, but no. He was old nevertheless. He doesn't even know it's Monday, apparently. Like, right, Mitch?
Today?
Today is Monday, my friend.
Is it? Oh, my God.
Yeah.
After Mitch talked about it on the recent episode, and I remember looking at it when it was on GameFound, I said, right, okay. I was on the edge there. I think it was the shipping at the time that sort of made me decide not to get it in the end. But I found a secondhand copy on Facebook, and I've played it a couple of times now, and yeah, it's every bit as good as Mitch said. It just has so many tense, tough decisions. That decision between playing it in on its hidden power and you'll keep it in your deck, or going revealed, which is much stronger, but you'll lose them. I think the tempo of that game is genius in that I got stuck the first few times wanting to just kill every enemy on a mission. But if you go for that every time, you will burn through your deck so fast and you'll run out of steam and won't be able to get there. So it's learning the game a bit and taking risks sometimes, hoping there's not like an engineer that you flip or whatever other tricks they have up their sleeves. But that is such a solid solo game. It's so easy to learn. And man, it's tough, like really tough.
It really hits a number of spots because it's like easy to set up. It's playable in a small amount of space. It's deep and thinky, even though the decisions are difficult to make, actually, you know, executing them is not difficult.
Yes,
it's a phenomenal game. Phenomenal game.
Yeah, I've just been enjoying that so much. Like that. That'll be one, like you said, Mitch, you'll chuck it in your bag, you'll take it with you to work. I'll go with that many places, that game as well, for sure.
Just a quick one. Do you think it's the best pure only solo game you've played?
Because
it's purely solo, so you can't count things like Cloud Spire and all that. Like,
yeah.
It's just a solo game.
I would have to say yes. I don't have many. The best metric to go by, but it's probably the best solo only game I've played. But not only that, it's probably the best solo experience I've had this year.
Okay, cool.
I'd it's a bigger hill to climb when you're talking about me, because I've got a hell of a lot of solo only games, and Nemo's War was in that bunch, right?
Because it is.
Even though Nemo's can be played multiplayer, it really can't. It's terrible multiplayer. So look, I wouldn't go as far to say it's the best solo experience ever. It might be the best solo card game that I have.
Yep.
Because that, you know, just being able to, as you say, carry it around in a small package. And if you just took the cards and didn't take the box, you could see you could do it even smaller.
Yes, yeah.
So it would definitely be up there as the best solo card game I've got. We'll have to see. Come the end of the year, let's see where it lands.
Yeah.
It's very, very good.
Yeah. Nice. David Thompson's on fire.
Yeah, absolutely.
So what else have we been playing? A little bit more Caesar. Really enjoying Caesar. Like, holy moly, it's so good. And I got to play The Estates. I haven't played that in a while. Man, that just hits good as well. Like, it's so cutthroat. Love that game to bits. I don't really see people talking about it a lot, but it's
a great game.
Oh, it's so amazing.
Good. Do you think, though, the reason it doesn't... Like, any time I felt that I've played it, I don't feel like there is an optimum strategy or anything. I feel like there is a lot of randomness, as in the fact that the game can change on a dime and everyone can just go from being doing really well to really badly in a really fast minute. Like, I think it's – I haven't played it enough. I've probably played it 3 times, maybe 4 times, and those – gaps between each game have been like 6 months, very, you know, sparse plays. So I feel like, you know, all of a sudden the road gets extended and I'm like, oh God, I can't build there anymore. Then I start doing something else. Then, oh, that's the one that becomes negative points. And
interestingly, I feel like at the high player count, so maxing out at 5, like there's a lot of things that are out of your control. But the game I played recently was 3-player and that felt really tactical. I actually was starting to think I made decisions not to win certain companies at the start of the game. So it actually ended up getting palmed off to someone. They had 3 to manage, which became their downfall. That's too many to manage.
Yeah, 100%.
And tactically passing on things, knowing that someone else would pay up and I'd have more money for the next thing. It felt much more tactical at 3-player. Yeah. Then 4 and 5, but I love the zaniness of it.
I've only played out 4 and 5, but I can see what you mean. Going down to a smaller player count, the turn orders coming around to you just that much quicker. It can really kind of mess with the game.
That's like part of the game, in the sense that it's like, the game is not anything like 6 Nimmt, but in 6 Nimmt, you're not really playing the numbers. You're playing what you think that other people are going to play.
Yes, that's right.
So it's sort of the same in the Estates, right? You're trying to preempt what the other people are going to do and how they're going to play. So even though it's like, I wouldn't call it randomness, because if you're tuned into the other players enough and you've watched how they've played, you should be able to predict what's coming from them.
Yeah.
Yeah, but then you've got players like me who don't have a clue what they're doing. And then when someone goes, oh, he'll definitely pick up that yellow 4 now, it's in the bag. And then I pick up the green 2 and go, put that out and go bid on that. Everyone's like, why did you pick that one? Like, there's nothing.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. I always enjoyed it. It's always been like a game that's never overstayed its welcome either. It's never been like a game that you play and it goes like, oh, this has gone on too long. Like, why are we here for 1 hour and 15 minutes? Even on a long game, like, it can go for like 1 hour and 15. Yep. Like, but it never overstays welcome. There's always loads of banter, loads of trash talking. Like, and it was quite a funny. I played it once and like I embezzled and then someone else embezzled. And I felt like it pressured the rest of the people that played to also just embezzle.
Yes, it
does. Because they're like, hang on, he embezzled and that guy embezzled. I better embezzle. And then the third player embezzled, the fourth player embezzled, the fifth player embezzled, and it goes back to you like, I'm going to embezzle again.
Yeah. Like, and then that pool of money just keeps shrinking and shrinking.
Yeah.
And it makes the game tighter. Every dollar matters. Yeah, it's really good.
It's a fantastic game.
And there's one other game I've fallen in love with recently, a little abstract game called Quarto. Have you guys heard of Quarto?
No.
I think I've heard of it.
Yeah,
I've never played it.
Same publisher that does Corridor and Pylos, those sort of white box abstract games.
And they've kind of got the wooden pieces?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
So Quarto is, we haven't heard this phrase for a while, it's Connect Four on steroids. So
Connect Five.
Not quite. So the game comes with a 4x4 grid, and all the pieces are either light and dark, like chess pieces, or you've got tall, short, you've got hollow top, non-hollow top, and square and round. And all you do on your turn is pick one piece from those pool of pieces and you give it to your opponent to put down. And then your opponent will then pick a piece and give it to you to put down. And all you're trying to do is make a line of four of one of those attributes, of the eight attributes in the game. So a line of four square pieces, or a line of four tall pieces, or a line of four dark pieces, or four with a hole in the top. And so you really got to think carefully which piece you're handing over, because you're giving it to your opponent. So you might go, okay, yep, I think this is a safe piece, but they might see something you don't. It's very clever. And when you're ready to take it up a notch, not only can you win the game by creating a line of an attribute, but a square of an attribute. So just a 2x2 square of one attribute on the board. It's fast playing. It's very thinky. And it's just simple, and it's really good. It's really, really good.
Yeah. It sounds like, is there like a limit to the number of pieces as well that come through? Like, can you run out of a particular type, or?
I think it is. I don't know if it's mathematically possible to have not a single attribute represented on the board if all the pieces are out. I could be wrong. Maybe there is some combinations, but I don't think so. Especially once you add in that make a square or a straight line of an attribute.
Because I'm thinking you're probably going to get to a point where you're trying to force the person into a situation where they have to play something for you to win, right?
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So, yeah, it's really about really watching what you're putting, because it has consequences in multiple directions for the rest of the game. It's very clever. I really like enjoy it. Yeah, it's really good.
And just two players?
Two-player game.
Yeah, okay, cool.
So I've been enjoying that one as well.
Best nice. Two-only player game I've played, Jules.
No, probably not, but it's just... I got this, like, they have, like, a big version, which is, like, good for a coffee table, looks really nice.
Wooden pieces,
but I bought the miniature version, which is super compact. So
I have seen a couple of their games recently. They've always got a similar box, hey, like you said, that white background with like a quite prominent coloured piece on it and stuff. And they've always been quite popular. I can't remember the name of the other one. There's like a fox on the front of it from a memory, like a abstract looking fox. I'll look it up and I'll let you know by the end of the show. Yeah. But yeah, they've always got, you know, nice looking games. So
So about you, Adrian, what have you been dabbling in this week?
Mate. I've been dabbling in concrete prep at my house. It's been terrible. I haven't played hardly any games. It's so bad.
Is that a hobby adjacent thing as well?
Hobby adjacent thing, right? Been on the plate compactor, compacting road base, you know, like 6-cube. It's pretty efficient, like resource management. Now, I tell you what did happen. I was tired as, and I was getting frustrated because the rain was coming, and I swung the lump hammer down, missed the post I was supposed to hit and hit myself in the kneecap. And then my knee just swelled up like a balloon and went bright pink, and I couldn't walk the next day.
Jeez.
You know what it's like when you're rushing and trying to get stuff done, and then like that's when everything starts to go
different. Yeah.
And you're like, and then it gets worse, perpetually worse, and you get more behind as the more you fluster and rush. That's basically what happened to me on Saturday.
That's why I like the difference between my job and your job, Adrian, because you rush around and cut corners and you hit yourself in the knee with a hammer.
Yeah, when I rush in my
job, I just mistype a word.
Yeah. Oh, I thought you meant like, you know, you actually cross off the wrong box in Fleet, don't you? Like when you're rushing to your job. I'm going to rush. Hang on a second. Oh, no, I was supposed to go prawn. Sorry about that. Just to put you on hold again, mate. Wait there. I'm supposed to do oyster. So, yeah, I did a little bit of that. And also, like, Like, yeah, not a lot, guys, if I'm honest. I played a few games with some people. I taught Barrage to Matt Woods and a friend of his, Shane, which was always great to play that game. And I kind of was like, I know that these guys play a lot of games and wanted to see, you know, I wanted to show them the game with the expansion in it. But if I taught the game without it, I knew that that process was going to be like another game away, if you know what I mean. Like that.
Yeah.
And I've talked about it before, like we've all talked about it. Like some people say a sign of a good expansion is one that you can teach with the game, or the vice versa. Maybe you don't think that's the case. Maybe you want to have enough crunch in the game that when you add the expansion, it becomes like a whole new experience. Like, and I felt teaching it with the expansion was an okay thing to do in a small group in a quiet setting. Like I thought that was fine, and yeah, it was fine. The guys did really well. I actually came, I think, second. It was a long teach though. Like it was like 45, 50 minute teach, because they'd never played the base game, didn't know anything about Barrage. So I just did the most full teach I possibly could, with like a sort of Q&A thing at the end before we started. But once the game started to get motion, it went really well. Like it was fantastic. And they both really thoroughly enjoyed the game. And Shane, the other guy at the table, said, I don't really go for games like this at all, but that's two for two. You know, I loved Pipeline and I loved this.
So, oh, yeah. You
know, maybe he is a heavy Euro gamer. He just doesn't know yet.
For not a heavy Euro gamer, and you've given him Pipeline and Barrage.
Yeah, like, and he thoroughly
Do you really
them.
Dislike this guy or something? Like what?
I don't know. He just, yeah, maybe. Maybe I'd try to break him. Like, yeah. I'd be like, okay, let's get something else out next week. Let's go Kanban next.
He tried to break me when it was at your place. We played Pipeline with the expansion at 8 in the morning.
Yeah. That's the perfect time for that game. That's the only time my brain works. But like it was a good experience. I really liked teaching them, and it was just great. It was great to play, so it was really enjoyable. Other than that, I actually got to play Flamecraft today.
Mm-hmm.
That recently delivered, didn't it?
Yeah, recently Kickstarter delivered.
Pictures pop up around, and a lot of people are saying how amazing the artwork and the production quality is.
And, like, I was told that the actual artwork and stuff came first. And
then built
the game around that world that had already been built.
Yeah, right.
But it was enjoyable. It was really good. It was fun. It was a little bit more thinky than I thought it was going to be. I think when you have that, like, kind of cutesy art style, sometimes it can be quite misleading, and to think, oh, there's probably not as much of a game there. It's more about the art and the theme.
Like Root.
As opposed to the actual... Yeah, maybe like Root. There you go. Prime example. But then there was a good game in there for sure. And it was beautiful. Like even just some really small details in it that I thought, what a great idea. Like it's such a small thing to add. It made it thoroughly enjoyable. Even to the point of in the game, in the actual box, it has two resource trays that are on top of each other. They're quite thin and they have all the resources in, but you just put one in each end of the table so everyone can reach the resources.
Instead of one big one, you have to pass around the table.
Yeah. Mm. Like, yeah. Or even just like you get this really lovely, beautiful resource tray and you're like, okay, give me your dish. I'm going to put 12 of those in and 6 of these in. And this is your dish for this end of the table. It was like they just came out, took the lids off and away you go. Kind of almost similar to the one in Res Arcana, but just a skinnier one that sat on top of each other.
Okay.
Yeah, right.
But it's brilliant. But mechanically, and that was really interesting. The dragon powers were really cool. How you can sort of visit a shop and then swap dragons and move them around to gain benefits and stuff. Another game that I did completely terribly at, but I enjoyed the game. It was fun. It was something different as well. Something that it had different mechanics in it. It was good. It was fun. Right. But other than that, guys, haven't been playing a whole heap apart from one big beast that I'm really excited to talk about.
Right.
I'll zip my mouth closed and wait until later.
You're going to hold off on that one?
No, I'm lying. It's Barrage, the Nile Affair. Just jump in. You can't do that to me and say hold off. That's not going to happen. Man, we play tested this game. We were lucky enough to play test it, and we were also very lucky enough to get sent an early copy to show at PAX. And this will definitely be my sizzling game. It's an expansion to my number one game of all time. it added an element to the game that didn't make it harder per se, but just added enough to the game to make you, people who've played it a lot, give them something different to do and a different type of engagement. Because the original game, it has a lot of area control elements to it for a Euro game, in the fact that not just are you kind of blocking water and stuff, but you also steal water and move it to different sides of the map. But this, with the Nile expansion, you have the Nile River that runs down the center of the board. And you can actually, anyone that controls the dams, just like you would control the dams originally and run your conduits to generate energy, you actually are able to irrigate the land and water the land to the Nile River. So because the Nile River is just one river that runs down the center, you need to build left and right of that river the dams that catch the water in those basins. Therefore, if you have water drops in there, you can choose to run your conduit, or if you don't have a conduit, you can choose to place a worker physically on the map, because there's no worker spots on the original map. On this one, you place a worker on the map, you irrigate the land by taking a water drop out of the dam, and then you get a benefit. And there's eight tiles all stacked up on top of each other in a row of four. So there's two, 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 and two. And each of these have a unique special ability. So when you irrigate the land, you get to take the tile. And at the start of your turn or the end of your turn, you can flip the tile and do that unique ability. That could be anything from a free build action to running the turbines and generating power at like a plus two up to the maximum. It makes it a tighter game because people are really congested around that Nile River.
Yeah.
Especially in a two-player game. Now, I really enjoyed it at four. Don't get me wrong. I thought it was a fantastic experience. We played it today. Def, Emily, Matt, and myself. It was great. I really enjoyed it. But I feel that it really sung at two players, actually.
Interesting.
Because in Barrage, you can play it kind of passively. Like when me and MJ first started to play the game semi-regularly, we would just build our own things and do our own keep out of each other's way and play it more like a Euro game just to get used to the mechanics and stuff. And as the hatred built between the two of us, we just started to screw each other up to the point of MJ refusing to play anymore. So, but it forces you together in a two-player game because you need to be in those rivers and in those headways to get those irrigation tiles, because those irrigation tiles, not only do they give you a one-off special benefit, which can be really powerful, you can do some crazy combos with those. It also gives you a little number in the bottom corner, which is like a dominance number. So if you have number two on the tile, it's usually a weaker ability. Correct. And then if you have a number one on there, it's usually a stronger ability. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the round, you add those numbers up, and whoever has the most of those numbers of the irrigation tiles with the highest amount of numbers on wins the round for that dominance. And when you have irrigated the land more than anybody else, because you've contributed to the crops and society, not just producing energy for your own corporation, you actually get this massive benefit of scoring a bonus point or a bunch of bonus points. Now, it gets really interesting in the fact that the more tiles that you take off of the irrigation and the more you expose, and by the end of the game, I think we only had one left out of the 16 or so tiles that were in there, 24 tiles, sorry, you get more victory points because there's victory points underneath the two tiles. Okay. So as you start to expose more and more, that number goes up and up and up throughout the game to becoming stronger and stronger and stronger. And it was, it's a really good experience for two players because you really have to be around that. You can't just let someone do it all themselves and steal the water and do their own thing, because they're just going to, they're going to potentially run away with it, especially if they're getting first place every single round. Now, there is an interesting catch-up mechanic in there, in the fact that after the first round, if you are the winner and you had the most irrigation and you get the bonus point, you get this the tile, the scoring tile, and you flip it over, and on the back, there's a minus one, okay? Mm-hmm. That minus one stays with you for the game. So your irrigation, let's say you did it five times and you had, you know, two tiles and a one, totaling to five, and you win the round with the five. The following round, that's only then worth four because you've got a minus one under your belt for winning the previous round.
Right.
And as the game goes on round by round, they get stronger and stronger up to like a minus two. So, you know, the more times you do it, essentially, the weaker you become in the irrigation market because you've got less water or whatever it is to irrigate.
So it stops like a runaway leader.
Yes, it does stop the runaway leader, especially in two-player. It didn't really happen so much in the four-player game. And I think Emily proved a very valid point of winning the game. She came second, which was very close to winning. I think there was only three victory points between her and Death, who did win. She didn't run the irrigation. She didn't even really use it.
Right.
She just did her own strategy, her own thing, and came really close. But Death did win, and it was a really tight game for the guys at the first two. And it was just, it was a great game. It's a game that I have always loved, still love playing. And then to add like something fresh and new and something different for me to work around and play with is just fantastic. And it's available at Essen. It's coming to Essen next week. And I know for a fact you can get it on the Anunnaki Late Pledge Manager and get it via straight from Cranio. But I know it's coming out to a retail, and it's not going to be that expensive because it's just a map in a little sort of plastic bag almost and a few tiles, and that's it. It isn't going to be a massive expense. But for anyone that plays Barrage, enjoys Barrage, it is definitely a must-have. And nice. Saying that now, I have five Barrage rule books.
Wait,
I've got the base game, the Automa, the first expansion, the five-player expansion, and the Nile expansion.
Oh, wow.
I also have an issue of the fact that the box, you've got no hope in hell of getting all that stuff in the first box.
Right.
That ain't happening. So I have everything in two boxes. So my only suggestion is, Cranio, if you do another one of these, release a big box that will hold the next one after the next one, because I know that there's two more maps coming. So don't do us, do us dirty and make us a box for this one or a couple of them. Just future proof that thing so I can keep buying maps for the rest of my life, you know? So, yeah. But yeah, it was a fantastic game. It always is. It's a long game. Like it's a heavy Euro, so it's always going to be a bit long, but it's always engaging and interesting. So
you were saying this is going to be available to be demoed at PAX in Melbourne, Adrian.
Yeah. Yeah.
Are you going to be at PAX?
I am going to go to PAX this year. It will be fantastic, and I'm so excited, as you can probably all tell.
So while
I get
we're
to
on
play
that.
Barrage, which is great, you know, can't wait that for that. So.
So, yeah, so while we're on that, everyone should be aware that the Board Game Barbecue crew will be attending PAX this year. It's next weekend now.
Yeah.
So by the time this comes out, people will be packing their bags and making their arrangements. I think Draven from our community, he's already in Melbourne. He posted in our Discord channel today.
Yeah, he's pitched his tent outside. He's first in line at the convention center.
To get his bus. So
that tent is just a facade. He's actually digging a hole underneath. He's going to dig up his way into the center of the convention, and we're all going to jump in and sneak in with him.
Oh, dear.
So if you're in Melbourne next weekend or if you're thereabouts, by all means, come down to PAX at South Bank and stop in and see the Board Game Barbecue crew there and play a few games in the tabletop area.
Can't wait for it.
And the night before, if you're there on Thursday night prior, there will be, we are getting together. So jump onto our Discord or onto the Facebook community, and there's the details of where we're meeting up for some drinks before there as well. So I might grab the ball off Adrian then and run into the game that I'm going to talk about as the one that I enjoyed most since I've been on the pod last. And I'm going to stick to the David Thompson bandwagon.
Mm-hmm.
And go with his latest in the Valiant Defense range, which is also my oath. So I'm kind of throwing out a bit of a spoiler here, but that it is Lanzareth Ridge, which is a solo-only game based around – I'm going to talk a little bit of time talking about the story here because I got the game, let's say, arrived on a Wednesday, and I was working, and I wasn't going to get the chance to play it on the Friday, but I was till the Friday. But I was super excited about it, and I wanted to sort of get involved, and you know, so I was reading the rule book, and I actually took some time to go and read and do some research on the story behind the Lanzarote Ridge and what happened. And it was really moving because ultimately, and I'm probably going to get some of the details not 100% correct. So if I say something wrong, I apologize. By all means, go and correct me by doing the proper research. But I think there was a total of, I think it was 22 people in this platoon who had been essentially charged with holding this ridge. They were initially out there to do some reconnaissance, and so they weren't. They were like a stealth team. They weren't necessarily a team that was supposed to be, you know, right into the in the battle. But they're a specialist stealth team. I think four of those people actually left because there was offensive all across the country. Sort of at that same time, it was the first day of the Battle of the Bulge. And they were led, so there was, I think there was 18 left after the four left. So 18 left in, on Lanzarote Ridge, led by Lieutenant Book, I think you pronounce it, B-O-U-C-K, who was only 20 years old.
Wow.
Yeah, so, you know, you think about, I think about my son who's only 19, and I think, wow, imagine being in command of, you know, 18 other soldiers. And they had to hold this ridge while they were being essentially watching the advance towards them of a unit of 500 paratroopers
wow.
and tanks from the German army. And when they radioed for help and they radioed back to headquarters to advise what was going on, they were told, stand your ground and do not move at any cost.
Wow.
So basically, get captured or get killed.
Yeah.
Is what they were told against those odds. Yeah, so it's really moving, and it's a very moving story to read all about it. And essentially that's what happened. The Germans came through, and initially they didn't realize that they were holed up in the woods, and so the battle went down, and they had to endure essentially four waves of German paratroopers before they ended up succumbing and being caught. They only had one casualty.
Wow.
To the Germans had significantly more than that. It was a pretty impressive stand. And even moving on from the stand at Lanzarote Ridge, there's a lot of information as to initially they weren't even recognized. They delayed the advancement of the tanks for over 24 hours, and which was a significant win.
Yeah.
I guess, you know, advantage in the Battle of the Bulge to hold the tanks off for so long. But then because it was kind of like an under, you know, it was a sort of a stealth mission, and initially it didn't really get talked about when they returned and the war was over. So they didn't actually get recognized for their efforts in battle until I think the early 80s.
Wow.
And they're now the most awarded or rewarded troop of soldiers from World War II, maybe of any time.
Wow.
Yeah. So it was really, really interesting. It's a really good story. And if people are, you know, interested in learning about that sort of stuff, I highly recommend have a read. There's plenty of information online about it, so you can look that up. But all of that story then goes into this game. And it's a solo game where you're essentially controlling the, I can't remember the name, the unit. They were 99th Infantry or something like that. And Lieutenant Book and his team, and it's kind of like has similar sort of feelings to if it's kind of tower defense-y, I suppose, because you have waves and waves of Germans that are coming through, and then you have decisions to make as to who you're going to utilize out of all of your team. There's so many good decisions in this game. There's different actions you can take on your turn, and you can move your troops. There's certain spots where they'll set up. There were foxholes dug at the time. There were certain positions that established as positions with, you know, attacking priority, and certain foxholes can attack certain areas where the Germans are coming through. So you're trying to balance it out to say, well, you know, I want to be sure that, you know, this particular area can cover these two sort of pathways in, But then they wouldn't have line of sight on these other ones. So there's a lot of decisions going on from that perspective. But then you also have the decisions around when you choose to take an action with someone, you have certain actions that are, I think they call them minor actions, and it's kind of like resist, Jules, and you can take a minor action and that person's then still available to perform another minor action later right. in the turn. But if you use a major action, then they become exhausted.
Yeah.
And they're no longer usable, that particular, round, essentially, that wave. So not only can you not use them in your next turns, but they're exhausted until the very, till the end of that phase. And then when you start the second phase, you can unexhaust them. But you also have characters like the lieutenant and some of the other more senior officers who have the ability to unexhaust some people.
Right.
But that action in itself is a major action.
Yeah.
So that'll exhaust the lieutenant. Wow. So then if you choose to do that, then you're losing all the other abilities and the benefits that the lieutenants have. So, it's super fun. It's super hard. I mean, as you expect, you want them to be, these solo games. It's just a really good game. I think it's hitting the spot in terms of the Valiant Defense series. The other ones that have come before it, Castle Ida, Pavlov's House, the Soldiers in Postman's Uniforms, it's got the same sort of feel to it in terms of gameplay. But I just really enjoyed it. I just found it exceptionally good from that aspect. There's a difficulty, you can ramp the difficulty up. So there's a phase where you add these event cards in so that every round you're playing with new conditions that will happen. So there might be a negative, it might be a positive, different things that come out depending on what you draw for these events that occur as the game goes along. And it's phenomenal. You have to manage your ammunition from some of your machine guns. There's certain machine guns that you have that you can have them mounted in certain sections. And you've got to control how much ammunition you have. Obviously, if you're in that scenario and you're on a ridge, trying to hold a ridge with no support, no backup, no anything coming, then you're only going to last as long as the number of rounds you have. So, there's definitely an efficiency puzzle in trying to work out when to use those rounds, to make sure that you get the absolute best out of taking those shots with those guns. So it's if anyone's interested in that sort of war game genre, those, historical events that happened, it's all true. It's all a real life event, and the gameplay matches that really well. So it's not difficult. It's not there's heaps going on every round. The German side is super easy to play. You literally just turn over three cards. The cards tell you what to do for the Germans on each turn. So if anyone's into that thing or has thought about getting into that sort of that thing, I'd highly recommend Lanzarath Ridge because David Thompson is just on a roll, and he's kicked this one out of the park again.
Yeah, I've been interested in them since you and Def have been talking about them, and I've been lucky enough. One of the community members, Scotty, he's lent me his copy of Castle Itter to give a go.
Yeah, right.
So okay. I'm keen to bust that out soon.
Absolutely, they're super fun, and I think when you take the time to understand the history behind those events and the true things that happened. It really makes the experience that much richer.
Brings it to life, yeah.
Absolutely, absolutely, yeah. So that's my sizzler for the pod is Lanzarath Ridge.
I got one more question about it.
Yeah.
Have you played all the other games in the Valiant Defense series?
I haven't played all of them. I've played Pavlov's House. I think it's the only one I've played.
Okay.
Yeah.
I was going to ask, how different does it feel to the other ones? In terms of mechanics and things like that?
It's a good question, actually, because there are definitely similarities. Uh-huh. Primarily, the first thing I think of with the similarities is that you're advancing, the enemy are advancing along these tracks as they come in and have that same mechanic. So you're watching these tracks fill up, and obviously your attention tends to go to the ones that are getting the fullest first. So that's a similar sort of thing in Pavlov's House. But then in Pavlov's House, you're very restricted in terms of your movement because they're all in that house.
Yeah.
And they also have some supply lines that are coming through. So they're actually getting supplies that they can bolster themselves with as the game goes along. Whereas in Lanzarath Ridge, you you have everything you have at the start of the game.
And you get no more.
There's nothing more coming in.
Yeah.
But you actually start with more than you would in Pavlov's house. I think Pavlov's house, you only have a handful of guys.
Yeah, right.
Whereas Lanzarote Ridge, you've got the full 18 of them.
Yeah.
Right. But you spread across a much bigger area as well.
Yeah.
So it's kind of, yeah, there's sort of twos and fros and things. Yeah. So there is definitely similarities, but there are also very specific things that are different as well.
Yep.
I did read, I think, I don't remember who it was I was reading, was commenting about playing both, and they said that, I think they said that at the time Pavlov's House was their favorite, but this one very well could pip it.
Okay.
Enjoying it as much as they did. So, you know, it squarely sort of lands in there. It's definitely going to be on the same level as those other ones.
Okay.
In terms of playability and the fun and so on, yeah.
Cool.
That's good. So that's Adrian's sizzle done, mine done. Only leaves one more, Jules. What's your game of the week?
Yeah, so we'll transition from wartime to a different war. This is trolls and gnomes fighting each other. I'm going to talk about Fall of the Mountain King. So this is by Burnt Island Games. This is a game that is a prequel in the universe that they made for In the Hall of the Mountain King. This is a area control war game, but it is very different to anything I've ever played before. So it's an area control war game, but you do not fight with your opponents, and it's not cooperative.
Right.
So you each play as different clans of trolls, and the gnomes are invading your mountain home. And essentially, you're trying to gain victory points or notoriety amongst the different clans by dying gloriously in battle to these gnomes and taking control of different areas on the board. And the thing that really drew me in to back this game was the really unique action selection mechanic that it has. It has a bunch of cards, and you do a draft, and you build out what's called the ancestry. And it's very much like Smartphone Inc., where you lay cards on top of each other. So you start to build out this grid of cards that you must lay at least one. It's a 2x2 card. You must lay at least one corner over when you're placing new things down. And you can never go bigger than a 6x6 grid total from memory. And once you've laid out those things, all these different symbols are then the actions. And you can do a combination of either weak actions or strong actions. And the weak actions would be you put a little marker on one of the symbols in your ancestry you've built, and you just do that action. But if you've been able to chain things together adjacently, you can put down as many as you want in that line and do it as a strong action. And the clever thing is, once you start putting down these cubes, those cubes can link other symbols together if you didn't already have them adjacent. So there's this really cool puzzle of trying to get these actions optimized in a way that will achieve what you want to do. And I'm not going to sit here and explain the whole game because it is quite involved and there's a lot of interwoven things that you're trying to do, but just that action selection mechanic and building out that puzzle and then trying to find a way for it to make it work for you in the game was just a real joy to play. I really thoroughly enjoyed it. There's lots of heroes that you can recruit along the way that start to give you asymmetric abilities from the other players, and you definitely feel as the game progresses through the three ages, I think you play over, the gnomes just keep coming in stronger numbers and bigger waves, and they eventually really totally overrun you, which is how the game is designed, because then the following game in its history, in the Hall of the Mountain King, you're coming back to that place and rebuilding it from, you know, the ruins of that battle, which I find really cool. I'd love to have a game day where I play one after the other and sort of have... Look, they're totally different games, but it has the story connected. I think that'd just be a fun thing to do.
Just got to wait for the third one first, right?
Yeah, that's it. They'll be launching Trolls Going to Space.
Yeah. Is that what it is?
No, no.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised.
There has to be a third one though, right?
It would be cool.
Yeah.
There's something about a trilogy. Two is like, trilogies are a thing.
Two's a failure. All the greats are trilogies. Back to the Future.
Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. You know, Star Wars, until they stuffed it up, made it 9.
Yeah, so I'll come back to what I said earlier, that it's an area control war game, but so different because you don't fight each other. You'll take over control of areas, and that will earn you favor in clans, but that's it. There is no fighting with each other. You're jostling for position to be the one at the front line to get hit by the gnomes, because you'll earn victory points for dying in battle against them. And you also go out and fight the gnomes, and you can defeat them and earn victory points that way. But movement is really restrictive and hard in the game. It's got some very clever ways
because it's still tunnel-like, Jules? Or
there's not
so... just you don't get a lot of movement.
It's... How the movement works is you pick one area and it's like a vacuum. Then you can pull units into that area.
Right.
So you can't spread out easily. It's always sucking units into one place. But there's no movement values. You can just move a troll from anywhere to the location you've selected, as long as you can link it through areas that have at least one of your trolls present. So they kind of like flow through each other. You're building networks of trolls on this map. It's very, very clever, very well done. The replay value is sort of off the charts with the amount of heroes that that are available in the game, and just the variable bits with the board setup. They change a few things here and there, but I really enjoyed it. I've only played it once, but I'm really looking forward to playing it again. I'm so happy I backed this one. It's something that... like I've said, it fits my favorite type of genre of games, area control, but it's so different, and I think they've done a fantastic job of this one.
Nice. Yeah, right. I want to play it.
Mm.
Have you played the original one, Adrian?
I've got the original one. Yeah, I have
it's
it.
So
it's
good.
Like, okay. It's a really good game. I've said it before, and I said again, it's like Dungeon Keeper, the board game. Like, that's exactly what it reminds me of.
Yeah, right.
But it's just, it's a really good game. I really enjoyed it. I've only played it a handful of times, but it was, really enjoyable. I'd like to try this one because I don't really like area control games that much, but I always like those ones that are different. Like,
I was going to say.
The King is Dead, Condon Cherry.
Yep.
I liked Ankh because it had all the different things and the powers where people then join. Like, that was a different point of difference that made it interesting. And there's no fighting in Ankh. It's there is, but it's predetermined on that timeline type of thing. So you know what's kind of coming. You're not just going to have someone go, aha, I've pulled this card. Now you're completely dead and I've decimated your entire army. Like, whereas... I'd like to try this.
It is like that in Fall of the Mountain King, because you know that the wave of gnomes will happen at the end of a round. So you know when that's coming. It's when everyone's used their actions. You can fight existing gnomes on the board, and you'll get a few victory points for that, but it's the really big points come in each wave. So
Yeah, it sounds really good.
Mm.
It does sound good indeed. But well, that's the end of our little chit-chat for the day. We will now move on to our question of the pod. All right, so question of the pod. So the question of the pod from last episode was, what was your gateway game that got you into the hobby? And I got to say, this one really sent our socials pretty crazy. We had loads of responses.
Hundreds. It was so funny because I was like, oh, we're going to read some of these out. And we start looking at them like, we can't possibly read.
Not even
5% of these out.
No. Like,
it would be the whole episode with just reading out people's answers, because obviously people are keen to talk about and to share, that experience that they had that was obviously so fulfilling and rewarding that got them, sort of pulled them into the hobby. So that was great. Did you guys grab any in particular that you thought were fantastic and wanted to read out?
Yeah.
Yeah. Go for it, Jules, after you.
Yeah, I was looking through the post that we put on Facebook. There was a few comments I saw. Jess said that Carcassonne was the beginning of the sickness, and it was new back then. Richard said that originally he was into like miniature style games like Blood Bowl, HeroScape, Warhammer 40K, but then they dropped off that and then was introduced back into the hobby with Mice and Mystics, which immediately led into all kinds of other stuff, which I found really interesting. I resonated with that.
Haven't heard of Mice and Mystics.
You haven't heard of it?
Oh, no. It was a big deal when it came out.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a story sort of narrative game, isn't
it?
But
yeah.
Okay, yeah. Cool.
And we had Liz say Betrayal at the House on the Hill was her gateway game and had been dabbling a little bit in Magic the Gathering. And then she was invited to play with some other friends later that year and saw their collection and decided this is the hobby for me.
There was a lot of people who said Magic the Gathering. We did actually put a post up on the board game group on Facebook.
Yep.
And we got loads of responses. So thanks to everybody from the board game group who's commented on there. There was almost 300, I think. It was crazy. But there was a lot of sort of a bit of a common sort of run there. We had Catan was a big one that came up as people's entry.
Mm-hmm.
Hero Quest, for those back that were sort of grew up in the late 80s, early
90s.
Yep. Magic the Gathering and Dungeons and Dragons was a big one. People coming over from RPG games like D&D into the hobby, which was good too.
Yeah, that was my experience. Like when I was young, it was Magic the Gathering, Warhammer, Catan, Risk, Billionaire, those sorts of things. The more recent, well, it's not a recent game, but it was what really got me fully into this was Cosmic Encounter. Loved that game.
Yeah, well, I was a bit of a D&D guy. You know, I played D&D at high school, and then I had a few friends at work that we used to book out a meeting room after hours on a Friday night, and we'd go there and play D&D for a few hours.
Cool.
And we ran into all the same problems that most people do with role playing, which was, you know, people couldn't make it all the time. You know, scheduling was difficult, and being a DM and you know, planning out the sessions and all the pre-work that's required from that aspect sort of was a bit of a turnoff. So I pivoted into board games thinking, you know, could I get a D&D-esque experience where I didn't have as much an overhead? The games would only go for an hour or two and you'd still enjoy your time doing it. So that's sort of where I came from as well.
We also had a couple of answers in Discord. One from Meg's Ruth, which I think this is probably the best gateway game of all time. So was Gloomhaven and played that for 18 months to 2 years before properly joining the hobby. It was originally meant to be our gateway game into playing D&D, but I fell in love with board games instead.
Wow.
So, wow.
That's quite a story.
What a beast, eh? Just like, I'm just going to buy this massive brick.
But I wonder,
play this.
I do wonder how many people look up number one board game and then that'll take them to Board Game Geek and then they see Gloomhaven and then they just buy it and then go what have the I hell? Done?
I don't even know if that's the case. It might even be like, you know, Googling something like D&D or something like that. Do you know what I mean? And then it's like a one-shot thing that you get all the cool stuff in it and you don't have to buy a module and buy a this and, oh, we need, you know, five other different things and a rule book for this and a different rule book for that. And you don't need is it DM? DM, right?
Yes.
Is it a DM?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, you know.
Well, if you asked someone, like if you went to someone who was sort of into board gaming and D&D and said, hey, I want to start D&D, what's a good place to sort of get started? They might refer you to Gloomhaven. They might say, give that a go, you know. Maybe that's the route it took. But that's a great story.
Mm.
Yeah. This is also a pretty good story. Kez, I believe, lives in Brisbane. I haven't met before, but has been referencing Brisbane a few times in the Discord. It says, I cannot recall my first board game that whacked me firmly and back into the hobby. But what I do recall is my friend Nathan's wonderful, open and inclusive, fun teaching style. It couldn't save all the games that were introduced to me, but those games I could remember I wouldn't have appreciated if they hadn't been taught with someone by someone with lesser attributes. So I'm guessing, said in the discussion we had last week, it was more like what was the situation as well? Like what was happening? What went from just going, oh yeah, I'll just play Cards Against Humanity or, you know, some sort of card game or whatever, to just like bang into this hobby and just getting this addiction to just keep trying to play all these different games and enjoying lots of different things. And it can just be that one person that just changes it for you. Like you just play that one game and it just, it completely gets out of hand from there, right? Pretty much.
Yeah, exactly. So, and how good is your teach if the person can not remember the game, but they remember your teach?
Yeah, that's it. Exactly right.
But, you know? All right. So, so moving on from that question, we need to then pose the question of the pod for the next episode. And following up from that, that one's going to be a challenge. But one that we've come up with is, what is your favorite hidden gem game? So what we mean by that is, so I'm thinking, you know, something that maybe not everybody knows about, something that's not turning up on every one of the must-have lists, something that's, you know, you a game you really, really love, but most people haven't played it. Well,
everyone hates it apart from you.
maybe they just haven't heard of it or haven't been exposed to it. Or, you know, I know when we started the pod, I think we did an episode on hidden gems. And one of the ones I think was that I used as my favorite hidden gem at the time was Condottieri. Which is, I don't think any of you guys had heard of that game at the time and hadn't played it. And I remember taking it to the retreat where I think we all had our first taste, or you guys had all your first taste of it, and loved it.
Rematch.
Yeah.
Right. Rematch. That's what I was saying. Rematch. Now that I remember what I'm doing, rematch.
So, you know, so that would be mine. Like that would sit in my sort of wheelhouse as my sort of favorite hidden gem, I think. What about you guys? What are some of your favorite hidden gems that are floating around out there?
I can go. Like I made this an oath a long time ago, and yeah, I played it a couple of times and it just fell off the bandwagon because, you know, get games, new games, trying games all the time and, you know, looking for different things. But this is something that I actually really want to get back to and play a lot because I know it has an immense amount of depth and a lot of strategy and really interesting mechanisms and card play. It's also been kind of touted to being sort of a successor of like the Glory to Rome line of card games. And it was just one of those games that I played it and I was like, it was when we were very busy and I did my oath and I played it and that was it. And I didn't really kind of keep playing it and really get into that repeat play mindset. But that is Motenai. That's how you say it.
Right. Motenai. Okay.
And
yeah,
it means don't waste, I believe in Japanese, or every little thing has a soul, which is kind of cool.
Wow.
But it's very deep, right? it's just a really small, tiny, tiny box with like, I don't know, 50 cards in, 60 cards in, and they're all multiple uses. So every card can turn to every different side and has a different use on every side of that card. And it's just something that, yeah, it's highly regarded by lots of people that do play it. It's very, very popular. It's not in the top 1,000 games of all time or anything, but it's a great game. And I remember playing it and going, wow, this – in fact, it was like – I think it was like a 3.2 or something on BGG for like complexity. And I remember back then when I was sort of really getting into the hobby and we were starting out on the podcast and stuff, it was actually a bit overwhelming, to be honest, because there was a lot of different things. And it's one of those games where if you play it once, that's grand, but you need to play it a few times to really get the game flowing and learn all that rule set and understand it all and what, you know, what goes of what and all the different integrated card play and that. But yeah, I definitely say Motenai is up there. It's a definite hidden gem, even if it's not overly appreciated by myself because of my lack of plays. I know there's plenty of people out there that love this game. So
yeah, right. How about you, Jules? Any hidden surprises in there?
Yeah, I've got one, but I was also thinking, I feel like Black Rose Wars is a hidden gem. Like, not that many people really know about it, and every time I bring it up, when people say, "Oh, what's your favorite game of all time?" I'm like, "Oh, Black Rose Wars." Like, never heard of it.
What? Yeah. Well, it kind of was sort of big when it sort of started coming out from the Kickstarter or whatever.
Yeah.
And then it kind of went back under the covers pretty quick.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it had the Black Rose Wars rebirth campaign, but the original was like, yeah, very small. Like, it wasn't a huge, huge success. It does have retail copies now, but that's only in this past year that's happened. But even then, like, not many people know about it. But the other one I was thinking of was Lords of Scotland.
Okay.
Which I have talked about on the podcast before. It's a tiny card game published by Z-Man Games. It's, yeah, you probably still can get it, but it might be a little harder to find. Really underrated, I feel. Like, really good. Can be very mean, very strategic, and quite a challenging, really fun game. It's card drafting and hand management, and you're racing to get to, I think it's 42 points. I can't quite remember, but you can alter that how long or short you want the game. But Lords of Scotland is really good, like really, really good. It's just clever. I won't talk about it again. Go to our website. Put it in the search function and have a listen. But yeah,
it was one of the first games that I ever played with you, Jules.
Oh, was
it? At your place. Yeah, I think we played it that night. That night I came down to Canberra.
Yeah, that's
and,
right.
And yeah, you destroyed me and you were gleefully laughing at my peril and demise. And I was like, what is this guy's gaper?
Yeah, but it's good. I just really enjoy it. I don't get to play it enough, but I mean, the theme is not really there, but yeah.
But it's a great little, like, thinky puzzle. Like,
very much so.
Because there's something about you have to play the lowest card, or there's the lowest card thing. Or
yeah, so each clan has a power, but that power to activate when you play it face up, it has to be the lowest number on the table.
Yeah.
So if someone just goes, slaps down a one start of a round, well, there's no powers going on this round then. There's nothing lower than one.
Yeah.
But then you can play them face down and get to reveal them. And if you play all the same clan suit, then you get that score doubled. And then there's lots of switching and making people discard cards. I think the thing I love about it is you have to manage your hand well. You might go hard on a round and then you've got nothing for the next because you keep your hand from round to round. You don't draw up again. So you've really got to time and pace things quite well in that game, which makes it super thinky. So, yeah, Lords of Scotland for sure is my hidden gem.
There you go. So that's the question for the pod of this particular episode. So we're looking for everybody in our communities, be it on Discord or Facebook, to comment on our post, tell us what their hidden gem is and why, and we're going to use those answers to check out some new games, check out some games that we haven't seen before, play some things that maybe, you know, aren't on the BGG hotness, but are actually really good games. So we're looking for input from you guys to do that for us. And like always, we'll go through that. We'll have a look at some of the best answers and we'll read the ones we enjoyed the most on the next episode. And that's probably a good time to just say that we do have ways that you can support the community. You can join our Patreon and be a Patreon supporter. And we appreciate all those people who have joined Patreon and support us. And you can also, if you don't feel obliged to do that at all, or you don't want to do that, that's fine. You can support us by just joining our communities on Facebook or on Discord and join the conversation with us. Be part of the team, be part of the group. It's really like a big family for us now. The new people that come in, they just slip right in and just become part of the conversation. So do that. Listen to us on Spotify or an Apple podcast or anywhere you listen to podcasts. Give us a rating. They do help us out with the algorithms. And if you do an Apple podcast 5-star rating and leave a comment, anything you like, Dan will use his old man spectacles to read that out on the next episode that he is on. So thanks to everybody who supports us in any way, shape, or form. We do really appreciate it. And with that, we will move on to the swearing of oaths. Do you guys know Dean from Advent Games?
Do I know Dean?
Yeah.
Of course I know Dean.
He's a legend.
Absolutely.
He comes to our board game days in Sydney. He brings a pop-up shop. He's got heaps of good product there to buy, and yeah, he's always willing to help people out and be friendly to his customers. Do you buy stuff from Advent Agent?
I do. I bought plenty of things from Advent, including an expansion to my most recent purchase. So it's the Food Chain Magnate. He had that in stock, and that's actually quite hard to get hold of at a decent price. So
he does get a lot of stuff in stock and carries a lot of things that people don't. And if you go onto his website at www.adventgames.com.au, you'll see that there's a whole list of different categories down the left-hand side of the page. You can not have to dig through reams and reams and pages of games you're not interested in. You click on one of those categories, get straight to what you want, and just buy it straight away.
That's it. I just click on area control, and that's all I need.
Unfortunately, I don't think he has a Stabby Friends in the back face
category. That's a suggestion, Dean.
So next time you're looking for board games, he has flat rate shipping, be it metro or regional. Go and check out www.adventgames.com.au and leave a message for Dean, because he's a good guy and we really appreciate your support, Dean. Thanks.
Thanks, Dean.
So our oaths, swearing of an oath. So I'm going to look at your faces and see who's given me good vibes, who's given me bad vibes. Adrian's shaking his head in terror, so he's...
Well, my last oath, I can tell you right now, I haven't done it because I was supposed to be at PAX playing Pampero, and that hasn't happened yet. That's next week.
Well, so are you filling in tonight for someone else? Are you weren't supposed to be on?
I don't know what happened. I have no idea.
I think it was a miscalculation.
Everyone's like, oh, God, I scraped him the bottom of the barrel. Let's put him on a third week in a row. Stuff. I will definitely fulfill my oath when I get the chance to. And I think it was to play, you know, the Barrage a Nile Affair. And stuff like that. And I love the title to that as well, the Nile Affair. It just sounds so cool. So,
a little bit Agatha Christie, isn't it?
Yeah, and it gives you that vibe. They're in those, like, the ladies and stuff are in those really cool kind of Agatha Christie-style dresses, or the, you know, 1920s, 1930s kind of look. Yeah. But yeah, anyway, Pampero is my oath, and, you know, just any PAX, man, I just want to go crazy at PAX, have like a great time, might get married down there to some rando, who knows, might marry Connor, let's just see what happens. I'm not going to say no. We'll go to PAX, baby. I'm so excited. Oh,
this is going to be off the hook.
Connor already promised to marry me, though, so.
That's all right. It's all good.
So, Jules, who are you gonna marry at PAX?
I didn't know this I was swearing. So my oath was to play Chaos Order. I have not done that yet, but I'm bringing it to PAX. So nice. I'd really like to get that done there.
So, can I play that? I'd love to play that on the table with you, Jules. That'd be great.
This.
Want to be the Terminators?
This segment of oaths is just going to be PAX related, isn't it?
We're
getting a little PAX overload, aren't we?
Nah, it's never too much.
It's going to be fun.
Your last oath, Jules?
I did, yes.
Let's hear about that.
Oh, that no, the one before. No,
he failed. He failed it. He said it. He failed Chaos Order. He's taking it to PAX.
So you're just doubling up the one you've already failed.
No. The last oath was to play Chaos Order. I have not done that yet, and I'll play it at PAX. That's what I'm saying I'm going to do.
Okay, but are you going to double up?
Yes, I am going to double up. Of course I am. What is this?
Oh, well, Adrian didn't, except to marry Connor. Ah.
No, I was looking at my games, and there's a few that I've played before or played once, and it's just been a while since I've got back to it. I really want to give it another shake, and that's Brian Boru.
Right, okay.
I played it once, and I thought it was really good. But I feel like I'm missing something with it. It just hasn't drawn me back to the table with it. So I want to bring that to PAX as well, because I keep hearing other people now are playing it and they're really enjoying it. So I want to give that another go. So I'll bring Chaos Order and Brian Boru to PAX and try and get that played over the weekend. That's what I'm going to do.
Cool. So that leaves little old me. So my previous oath was to play Lanzarath Ridge, which clearly I've done.
Yep.
I've spoken about that already on the podcast. And my new oath, I didn't really have one up until now, and I was just going to say I'll do stuff at PAX, but
you stole that. We already did that. That's why I jumped in, because I knew you were going to do it. And I was like, nah, he can go last and make it look like he copied me.
So what I will do for my next oath is I'm going to, I don't know. I want to do something at PAX as well, but.
You're going to fly the plane to PAX?
It's going to fly the plane to have pilot lessons in 2 days. Fly the PAX plane. Commercial airliner.
I'm gonna win the Microsoft Flight Simulator competition at PAX.
Yeah, there you go.
Yeah, I'll just put it out there to say I'm going to teach. There's a couple of the podcast members who have mentioned that they would like to learn to play the coin games.
Yes, I am one of them.
So I'm going to swear that if the opportunity allows, if we get the time, which I'm hoping that we will, I will swear to teach Cuba Libre to the other members of the pod who want to learn coin.
Nice.
Post-PAX event, right? Like 2 a.m. Well, starting time?
Yeah, well, it depends. I mean, you know, depends on the volumes. if we're sitting around and PAX is still running but there's no one sort of at our stand because they're like, oh, we've heard about those barbecue guys. We don't want to talk to them. Then, yeah.
That'll be us doing that to each other.
Yeah, probably. But, yeah, so that'll be my oath. And I think I'll just take the time to say something that I've forgotten what it was going to be.
Old man syndrome. And you ridicule Dad. You've got the worst memory out of all of us. You make me look like a genius.
I just had a thought, and I was like, oh, that'd be good to talk about at the end of the oath segment, and now it's gone.
Just remember, bacon bullets are your favourite food. Don't forget that, bacon otherwise bullets. You've got nothing.
No, I'm off bacon bullets. I'm off on my diet, or I'm going to die.
Yeah.
So, no, I've got to eat healthy stuff now, like quarter pounders. Yeah. All right. Now, well, that's our oath for the day, and we'll call that a wrap. So thanks, everybody, for coming along tonight and listening to the Board Game Barbecue podcast. Thanks to Jules for coming along. Thanks, Adrian.
Thanks,
buddy. It's always a pleasure.
And all right, the thing I was going to say, we are recording our next two episodes of the podcast from PAX.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That's right.
So those two episodes are going to be recorded from PAX.
So don't expect much.
There's a live streaming sort of setup or something going on there where we've actually been allocated two spots. So we will be doing two pods from PAX. So if you are not able to attend PAX, you'll still be able to share the experience with us through those recordings that we do. So have a listen along to those if you can't be there, or if you can be there, just listen anyway.
And if you are there, on the Saturday at 4:30 p.m. is the first recording, and on the Sunday at 1 p.m. is the second recording. We don't know if people can come and watch or get interactive with it. We don't know what's going to happen. So if you're at PAX, make sure you come past, say hi, and hopefully we can have some other guests and stuff join us on the pod. So it should be interesting.
Cool. All right. So this time we will actually call it a wrap, and we'll end it there. So thanks, everybody, for listening. We'll talk to you next time. Bye.
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 And we're
classic Mitch.
There we go.
That's so good.
You know Dan's not going to edit any of that out.
No.
Yeah, I know.
He'll leave all that in there and be like, yes, sucked in.
And he edited out my last joke that I made about him and a Zimmer frame not fitting into Mike's house. And he even told me, he said, I'm not going to let that in. I was like, damn.
It's his chance to leave it in now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Add it back.
So now he's going to leave all that in, and I'll talk about
it. That was good.
Your waves are a little bit high on my side, Adrian. What do they look like for you?
Am I all right?
Yours look all right.
My waves are always high, mate. Boom. That is a secret segment, Dan.